From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Unbuilding the World Trade Center, we talk with William Longavisha about his new book, American Ground. He was given unlimited access to Ground Zero as it was being cleared. His book is not only about the engineering feats, it looks at the culture that developed around Ground Zero, including the effect of constant media coverage and the tensions between police and firemen. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the HBO documentary Journeys with George, a behind-the-scenes look at how presidential candidate George W. Bush interacted with reporters on the campaign bus. It will be shown tomorrow night, election night. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration is preparing a revised UN resolution on Iraq after consulting with other members of the United Nations Security Council. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the draft resolution should be ready to present to the full Security Council later this week. Boucher said the revisions represent a compromise with the opinions of other countries, but he stressed that the administration's basic position remains the same. The Bush administration wants the Security Council to approve a resolution stating that Iraq has failed to comply with its obligations under previous resolutions. It also wants to specify that there will be serious consequences, including military action, if Iraq fails to comply. With only hours left to go in a Senate campaign upended by the death of Minnesota Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone, the two top contenders for his seat held their one and only debate today. NPR's David Wellner reports from St. Paul.
Former Minnesota Democratic Senator and Vice President Walter Mondale, who jumped into this race last week to take Wellstone's place on the ticket, referred in the debate to his Republican opponent, former St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman, simply as Norm. Coleman, on the other hand, deferentially called Mondale Mr. Vice President, while highlighting Mondale's ties to business.
And Mr. Vice President, let me say very, very, very respectfully, when we talk about special interests and support from corporate America, that's been your world. That's the world in which you've lived. That's the world for the last 8 years, serving on boards of Cargill.
Mondale brushed aside the charges.
That's really charming to hear a Republican worry about a Democrat who knows something about business.
Statewide polls released yesterday show the two candidates in a dead heat. David Wellner, NPR News, St. Paul.
President Bush is making a final campaign swing through states with key congressional races. One of those stops was in Missouri. Tom Weber reports from member station KWMU in St. Louis.
The president and first lady were part of a rally for Republican Jim Talent's bid to unseat Democratic Senator Jean Carnahan. Mr. Bush told a crowd of Republican Party faithful that Talent's record of promoting small business proves he understands how to create jobs.
The role of government is not to create wealth. Is to create an environment in which the small business can grow to be a big business, in which the entrepreneurial spirit can flourish.
Carnahan doesn't have any big names appearing for her today, but has planned four events to close her campaign in a bid to win the final 4 years of a Senate seat originally won by her husband, the late Mel Carnahan, in 2000. For NPR News, I'm Tom Weber in St. Louis.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 54 points to close at 8,551 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 36 points, or 2.6%. The Nasdaq closed at 1,396. This is NPR News. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein indicated today that he might accept the provisions of a new UN resolution on weapons inspection. Up until now, Iraq's been insisting that it would only accept weapons inspectors under the conditions set by previous resolutions. But today, Hussein said he's waiting to see what any new resolution says. One of Britain's most influential pop musicians died yesterday while on tour. Lonnie Donegan was known as the King of Skiffle. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Lonnie Donegan was born in Glasgow, Scotland, but as a young man, he spread the gospel of American Dixieland jazz throughout the United Kingdom. He made his name as one of the pioneers of skiffle, which combines jazz, blues, country, and jug band music.
Oh, well, a Rock Island Nine, she's a mighty good road. A Rock Island Nine is a road to ride in. A Rock Island Nine, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like a fine. You get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Nine. Well, I may be right, I may be wrong. I know you're gonna miss me.
Lonergan scored a number of hits in England, but he was eclipsed by the many British superstars he inspired, most notably a skiffle group called the Quarrymen, later known as the Beatles. Lonergan died in Peterborough, England. He was 72 years old. Netta Ulubi, NPR News.
Officials on the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline say it's too soon to tell when oil will start flowing again following yesterday's big earthquake in the Alaskan interior. Aftershocks are still shaking the area south of Fairbanks, where a 7.9 quake struck yesterday morning. The quake damaged some brackets that hold the oil pipeline above ground. Officials say there are no breaks in the pipe itself. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center, my guest William Longavisha reports on life at Ground Zero in the month that the remains of the World Trade Center were deconstructed and cleared away. He was given unrestricted access to the site through the commissioner of New York's Department of Design and Construction. He not only had access to Ground Zero, he had access to the meetings of city officials, engineers, construction companies, and consultants. His report was first published as three lengthy articles in the Atlantic Monthly, which commissioned the story. He's a correspondent for the magazine and won a National Magazine Award last year for his cover story investigating the circumstances behind Egyptian Air Flight 990's plunge into the Atlantic Ocean. Longavisha is a professional pilot and is the author of an earlier book about flying called Inside the Sky. Although the initial idea of your book and much of the final book is about the engineering feat of dismantling the remains of the World Trade Center, your book is also a lot about the human experience of witnessing the unbuilding of the World Trade Center and the human interactions that took place at Ground Zero. You write, many felt they had stumbled into a war zone and compared it to something you'd see in a movie, but you say your reaction was different to that. What was your reaction when you got to Ground Zero?
Well, as an American, of course, I was shocked. I mean, this was clearly a very serious attack. Many people had died. It was a terrible tragedy and remains so today. However, as a wanderer of the world and a writer, my reaction was that, in a way, I had seen this before. I mean, there was my gut reaction at first was of familiarity. It was, I looked down at the rubble underfoot, the way it felt underfoot, the color, the dust in the air, the smoke in the air, the smell, and I had a feeling that I had seen all this before many times, and specifically, I had a feeling that I had seen it in the Middle East, in war zones, or the aftermath of war zones, and so. It was strange. I mean, it was very strange for me as an American. I just come in from overseas. I do a lot of work overseas to see this sort of foreign thing on our soil, but it was also a familiar foreign thing to me.
You're right. The truth is that people relished the experience. It's obvious they would never have wished this calamity on themselves or the others, but inside the perimeter lines and beyond the public's view, it served for many of them as an unexpected liberation. Liberation from what?
Again, I think we need to couch all of that with the understanding that it was also a shock. I mean, before going on with that, it was the people there were certainly not in any sense rejoicing. So we say I say liberation, but I don't mean a liberation with joy. It was liberation with regret, with a sense of the tragedy, with a sense of the loss of life, and with the sense of the political importance of this moment. I mean, this attack on the United States. With all of that having been said, liberation from the routines of daily life, liberation from emails, from the need to answer to superiors, from bureaucratic constraints. I mean, it was a sort of a fresh start place for everybody. It was so chaotic, so unanticipated. You couldn't plan for it. You couldn't lay and normal procedures for the first few months, at least, on top of it. Everything had to be invented. And this happened on a level that was unexpected. In other words, not only were the people who were doing this people who had not previously been anointed as problem solvers, they were typically fairly low-ranking people, construction workers, firemen, policemen, on a fairly low level. But they also didn't necessarily even know that about themselves. So there was this creativity and energy that was emerging all through the site that was taking people by surprise, and it was a form of liberation. Practically also there was something else, and that is that many of the people, given the dedication to the cause there, the day in, day out, night, day, 7 days a week, on and on, were liberated from family constraints. They were liberated from, they had a sort of an excuse and a reason not to be good fathers, in some cases probably good mothers, though there were very few women there. And it was sort of socially justified. So the experience was a lot like war in that sense, only of course no one at that point was shooting at them.
Yeah, so I think you're getting to that kind of crazy exhilaration that some people find in war because it is so out of the ordinary. And it's the kind of exhilaration that seems to fuel certain people in the military, certain war journalists as well, who, you know, voluntarily cover situations like that.
Absolutely it does. It's probably an addictive thing. And I think it's not a bad thing.
That's the thing. I mean, you know, when I think of it, I think, like, it's lucky there is that kind of exhilaration, or else how would people get through these experiences?
Well, and the impulse to go to war on an individual level, in my experience, is not to kill the enemy. I mean, the positive side, what people remember, what makes it so often a positive experience for the participants, is that, A, it's not very scary up close. There are exceptions, obviously. And B, there is this kind of liberation. I mean, there is enormous responsibility placed on the soldier, for instance, on the individual soldier. And so we were looking at that at the World Trade Center. That's absolutely certain. There's no doubt about that.
You're right. One of the unacknowledged aspects of the tragedy was the jealous sense of ownership that it brought about, an unexpected but widespread feeling of something like pride, like this is our disaster more than yours. Explain what you mean there.
The farther away people were from New York and Washington, the less possession they felt. Of course, the farther away they were from the United States, the less possession they felt, which explains a lot of the differences that now exist in the world politically. But as you moved toward the impact zones, and particularly toward the World Trade Center impact zone, which was the big one, you moved closer to possession. And the possession started with political responsibility in Washington. The various politicians and bureaucrats, officials, took possession of it mentally of the disaster. And then it also was geographic, so that as you move then through the suburbs of New Jersey, and I'm not talking right now at all about the possession of the people who lost family members. I'm talking about a more general thing that was going on. As you move through the suburbs of New Jersey, proximity to New York, the very lack of the World Trade Center visually became added to this sense of possession. I mean, if you could see it before and could not see it now, it was more your tragedy than it was those who lived over the horizon. And then you got, of course, to New York City, which is a very proud place, a very strong sense of self. There was obviously a very strong sense of possession. And finally, you had to really be either at the site itself when the buildings came down, but I don't think that was so much that. It was more later. You had to be inside the perimeter. I'm now talking about the sense of possession that ran through the actual operation that I'm writing about, which was not what happened on 9/11, but what happened afterward. Among the workers there was a very strong sense of possession, and it was enforced partly by this opaque perimeter wall. I mean, the truth is that people on the outside really did not know what was going on inside. People on the outside had this cartoonish image. People on the inside were affected by that image, but really did know what was going on. So the sense of possession in that sense was quite real and justified.
You say The firemen in particular felt they had a special relationship to the site, not only because they had lost 343 people there, but also because afterward their survivors, along with their dead, had been idolized as national heroes and subjected to the full force of modern publicity. Talk a little bit about that phenomenon that you saw of the firefighters being photographed and written up in the press and being seen as heroes, which, I mean, I think they really were heroes. It's probably hard to dispute that. But what's the problem?
The problem, I don't really see it as a problem. I would say that the word hero was, you know, much overused. It was cheapened by overuse. Again, I'm writing in this book about people who were at the site after the buildings came down, not who were at the site when the buildings came down. If you talk about the heroism that obviously existed at the moment of the attack, there was plenty of it, and it was shared. It was not just a question of uniformed services. If one has to look at these groups of people who were being incredibly heroic and altruistic by groups, which I kind of don't want to do, but you have to say that among the civilians also there was enormous heroism that day. No one had a lock on heroism on the day of the attack. I mean, people were extremely altruistic and many were completely self-sacrificing. But that's really not what I'm writing about in this book. I'm writing about the people who were there afterward. I think the word heroism was probably misapplied. There were people, of course, everyone was taking to some extent risks. But the risks, the truth is, in the end, no one was killed at the site. I mean, we have this tremendously, inherently dangerous environment, and no one was killed. Something else we might want to talk about. But heroism, I don't know. It no longer meant anything to me, at least there. The problem is that to what extent did people buy into it? I mean, on the outside, people were, I guess they were really buying into this myth or cartoonish image of the heroes of Ground Zero, as people said. And the all of that energy, that public emotion, which was, again, I think was very justified and understandable, was being focused on this relatively small group of guys who had this identity. They wore a certain uniform. They had big hats. These guys were not really mentally prepared any more than I would be or than others are for this kind of adoration. So some of them, I think the great majority of them, were just absolutely even-keeled about it, pragmatic, a little cynical. They understood the media. They knew that what they were doing there was a very serious job, specifically of looking for the dead. They were not overly affected by it. Others were affected by it. They began to pose to themselves. You could see it happening, striking tragic poses and striking sort of heroic poses.
What do you mean by striking tragic poses?
I often have the feeling in the United States today that many of us look at ourselves as if we were in the movies. We sort of see ourselves from the outside because we live in this media-saturated environment. When we drive down the interstate, we don't just drive down the interstate. We drive down the interstate in one role or another, depending maybe on the kind of car we have, the ad we've seen, whatever it is. Sort of the external view of self. That's what I mean. That was going on at the World Trade Center in among a few people in a large way. And it wasn't just the firemen. There were people who were participating in that who had sort of bought into the myth in every corner of that operation. You could see it on the perimeter among the few firemen who would go, for instance, to sort of work the crowds when the viewing platform was finally erected. It caused a certain amount of cynicism and resentment within the site. I think it was understandable. I don't think it was very important. It did not affect the operation.
My guest is journalist William Longavisha. His new book is called American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is journalist William Longavisha. His new book is called American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. And most of this book was originally published in The Atlantic magazine. You write a little bit about the conflict between the police and the firemen at Ground Zero. And you say that the police resented how their dead were being treated compared to how the firemen were treating their own dead. Can you expand a little bit on this conflict?
There was tribalism at the site. It was based largely on what uniform people happened to be wearing. Most people at the site came from the same level of society. It was very New York. It was very Irish and Italian. It was outer borough. But when people joined one group or another, whether the fire department or the police or the Port Authority police or, for that matter, the construction world, they seemed to assume differing identities, and those identities came into conflict at the site. I mean, I suppose it's a normal part of life, and so it's certainly not surprising. I mean, the surprising thing really was the idea that this would not be happening. The myth that was going on the outside of just everyone in lockstep, being heroic together, and so yes, there were jealousies. The treatment of the dead was one of the more difficult aspects of what was going on there. From early on, for understandable reasons, again, the firemen were treating the dead of their own dead with more pomp and circumstance than they were treating the dead of other groups, whether the police, who got a certain amount, quite a lot of pomp and circumstance, or the civilians, who got relatively little. And that was noticed. It was obviously noticed. It caused resentments, not just by the police, who felt that they had lost their own and had been equally heroic, but by the self-appointed representatives of the civilians, who tended to be the construction workers, some of whom, not all of whom, resented the treatment that the civilian dead were receiving. It struck me at the time as very odd. I mean, it was so obviously a mistake. It was so obviously causing frictions and unhappiness, and it would have been so easy to solve. I mean, it would have been, you simply could treat all bodies with equal pomp and circumstance, and for that matter, give them all a lot of it. It would have been easy to do, and the fact that it wasn't done, at least not for a long time, is kind of a window into the relatively closed societies that were operating there. I mean, people were, in a sense, it was naive of people not to be, it was innocent of people to be treating their own dead with greater dignity and pomp than they were treating the dead of others. It was not a mean thing. It was not to put others down. It had to do with living and thinking inside of a very small world of fraternal organizations.
You write about some looting near the site of the World Trade Center. What did you learn about that?
There was filching going on. I've learned to be very careful of the word looting. I think it arouses all kinds of emotions, and you know, the word looting brings to mind some sort of riot with people running through the streets proudly holding televisions as they run away. That's not at all what happened. But there was extensive filching, and it started early and it continued for quite a long time until finally guards were posted in any building with anything of value in it, and. It was pervasive. I mean, it was done by all groups, and no one had a lock on doing that. It was part of life at the site, and I actually was not particularly shocked by it. I mean, my job as a writer is to go in there with clear eyes to write as I saw it, history in the present tense, to try to get away from some of the excess of emotionalism surrounding the subject, and to talk to my readers clearly about what was going on there. But I never had a sense of outrage about this at all. In fact, it was perfectly understandable, I thought it was, because On the inside of that perimeter, in the secret world of the World Trade Center, away from public view, it was a lot like a war zone. It was a different place. It was no longer New York City. These buildings were no longer normal buildings. The filching that went on there psychologically, and I think even also morally and ethically, was very different from, say, walking into a standing building out in the normal city and taking things away. This was a very special place. All the rules had changed, and the sense of ownership had changed. When people were walking away, for instance, with a computer, taking a computer off a desk, well, who did that computer belong to? I mean, obviously, everyone knew that the computer belonged to the original owner, probably some company, but the entire building had been condemned. The insurance company probably technically owned it. What was the insurance company going to do with it? I mean, all of these things were very muddy, and in the chaos of that environment there, and the total breakdown of normalcy, it just was not shocking that this was going on. I don't think the people who did it were bad people, actually, and I think also it needs to be said that very, very few people actually did it. It doesn't take very many people to have a large effect doing that.
But you're saying that some of the people who did do it included people in uniform.
Of course, yeah. I mean, let's be realistic. Of course. And yes, enough said.
William Longavisha is the author of American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. And DK Publishing, publisher of Bill Wyman's Rolling with the Stones, the inside story of the rock and roll band told by a man who can tell it like it was. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with William Longavisha about Ground Zero. Also, David Bianculli reviews Journeys with George about how presidential candidate George W. Bush interacted with the reporters on the campaign bus. The documentary airs tomorrow night on HBO. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist William Longavisha. His new book, American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center, reports on Ground Zero during the months that the remains of the World Trade Center were deconstructed and cleared away. He had unrestricted access to the site. American Ground was first published as three lengthy articles in the Atlantic Monthly, which commissioned the report. Langevecchia is a correspondent for the magazine. Now, some of the things you say in your new book, American Ground, have actually been really controversial, and I'm not sure if you were prepared for the reaction that you got. In the New York Times, the book review by Michiko Kakutani described your book as cold-blooded. And Rhonda Roland Shearer, who founded the World Trade Center Living History Project, is even leading a protest against the book. She says you use slanderous innuendo to denigrate uniformed rescue personnel and construction workers. I'm wondering if you were prepared for this kind of response and if it's made you think about, if you feel like you were misinterpreted or if it's made you rethink things that you've said, just what your response is.
I'm not at all surprised by it. I expected it. This was a very tragic thing that happened, and people's emotions were very strong and still are. It also was something that confused people and I think deeply frightened many Americans and many New Yorkers. The response of grasping for a sort of mythological, heroic, somewhat tragic image was a normal thing. I knew that was there. The hyper-emotionalism was driving a lot of the site. And what has happened since then in the reaction to this book by relatively small groups but very vocal groups of people was inevitable, and I knew that. My problem is, as a writer, you go into a place like that, what am I going to write? I mean, what am I going to, am I going to participate, as many writers did, in the external view of and the, sort of the myth-making, or am I just going to call it like I see it, maybe for reasons of personality, but also in response to being the guy on the inside, I felt that I had to call it like I see it. And I think the surprise to me has been in the response that the criticisms seem to be most vocal by, they're coming from people who did not lose family members, but sort of have a very powerful sense of tragedy anyway. And this reviewer in the New York Times, for instance, seems to be one of them. I was taken aback by that particular review. As you know, there were two reviews, and they were quite opposite.
One in the Sunday Book Review and one in the Daily. The one I mentioned was in the Daily.
That's correct. And I think you can see in the conflict between those two reviews, you can see the opposing forces here. The other thing is that at some point, let's go back on this, Terry, for 1 minute.
Sure.
If you remember that on the day when those airplanes hit the buildings, you called me.
Yeah.
I had just arrived from overseas. You asked me what I thought, and you asked me if I was afraid or worried. And to paraphrase it, I told you that I was not. And I said that the reason I was not was that though I was very concerned about reactions like undue grounding of the airlines or the Americans who didn't want to fly the airlines afterward, I had this faith in the fabric of American society and the resilience, strength, and ultimate integrity of the United States. And I was therefore not worried at all. It's what I told you then. I did not know I was going into the World Trade Center at that point. When I got to the World Trade Center, what I found was very much that. What I found was this emergence of Americanness, of creativity and innovation and courage. I did not find a bunch of heroes. I did not find a unified direction, far from it, any more than I would expect that we would find that in the United States. People were not walking in lockstep. They were responding individually and in chaos and in creativity, much as the United States does. And oddly enough, I often thought about that conversation during my time there when you called me, because it sort of crystallized thoughts for me. about the United States. I was seeing there at the World Trade Center what it was that I had predicted the United States would look like to you at the moment of the impact. And my job as a writer going into that is, and particularly as an American writer, is to write about this country and the World Trade Center site in those terms as honestly as I can. I see no reason to be ashamed of the discord that happened there within the World Trade Center. I see no reason to gloss over the problems that existed any more than I see the reason to gloss over the problems that exist in this country. In fact, this is a country in which we don't gloss over those things, and we don't participate in undue myth-making.
One more thing on the subject. Were there any scenes that you witnessed that created difficult judgment calls for you in how to describe it? Or was it difficult for you to even figure out what you were witnessing or what your interpretation was of what you were witnessing?
There were some things I saw that I did not write about. I really did not write about personal tragedy here at all.
Why?
Because I felt it would have been exploiting the situation. I thought in any case plenty was being written about it, and I did not want to participate in that. You know, we know it's sort of because of years of covering, for instance, airline accidents. When you go up to the families of those who were killed and you say, well, how do you feel? And the people say, well, I don't feel very good. And that's hardly surprising. Okay, we know how people felt who lost family members there. And I didn't feel that it was appropriate for me, although I saw plenty of that, to go into it. I was writing about something else, which was the larger response of the United States as a group to this attack. So, yeah, there were things like that I did not write about. For the most part, though, I wanted to write, as I said, something like history in the present tense, and I wanted to bring to the subject some of the detachment that history automatically always does finally bring to a subject. I wanted to do it in the now rather than in the future. So that informs a lot of the decisions that I made about what to put into the book, and that is that I put in most of what I honestly thought, and that was informed by what I saw.
My guest is journalist William Longavisha. His new book is called American Ground: Unbuilding the World Trade Center. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist William Longavisha is my guest. His new book is called American Ground: Unbuilding the World Trade Center. We've been talking about the human response and human interactions in dismantling the attacked World Trade Center. Let's talk a little technically. What, in your estimation, was the most challenging technical aspect of unbuilding the World Trade Center?
There were many problems there that had to be solved for the first time. There were no plans. This was a true physical chaos with fire and toxic smoke laced with enormous significance and tragedy, with human beings lying inside it. It was incredibly difficult from a technical point of view to do this thing correctly. It's hard to single out any one thing, but if I had to, I would say that there was a group of largely of engineers and specialized firemen, collapsed building specialists in the fire department, who worked together from the very early days for weeks and months to survey the underground ruins, to know to measure the ever-changing conditions down there, seven levels below the street, in this netherworld through which rivers flowed, in which there were fires, and in which there were many surprising environments, to measure it and to map it so that people on the surface who were working at dismantling this huge disaster area could work with relative safety. The danger was always collapse. The danger for the people on the surface was collapse. And for the people underneath who were measuring this, the danger also very much was collapse. So that simply from the point of view of risk, if not of technical difficulty, those are the people, I think, who were just way, way out on a limb. It is surprising what they did. Their dedication was incredible to observe. Their calm under fire. It was completely unseen, of course, on the outside, which was focused on the tragic, heroic thing. These guys were not, they didn't think of themselves in tragic terms. They certainly did not think of themselves in heroic terms. They were doing unbelievable work there underground, and it went on and on and on because the conditions changed.
One of the risks from underground, and I think this was underground, that there was a lot of freon gas for, I guess, air conditioning of the building.
Right.
What were the risks that this posed, and how were those risks dealt with?
Well, the risks were essentially of suffocation. If the freon gas remained and no one knew, the risk was of suffocation. If the thing suddenly released, if the gas released, it displaces air. And there were many, many workers, hundreds of workers, firemen, policemen, construction workers on the pile at any given time, who might not have had the ability to escape if suddenly there had been a rupture of those main tanks, which lay in the bottom of this of the pile somewhere unseen and unknown. There was also some risk that if that gas contacted fire, open flame, it would turn into something similar to poison gas used in World War I and could actually actively go about killing people. There was no risk to the city from this. The gas would have dissipated. But there was certainly a risk to the workers who were immediately on the pile and who might not have been able to move fast enough to get away had there been a release. That was always a concern, or for a long time it was. Finally, that same group of people I was talking about, some of those same underground people, the surveyors, the fire department collapsed building specialists and these engineers, went down to the lowest level and found their way into the main chiller plant room through enormous ruin and discovered there so much ruin inside that chiller plant that it was concluded that the tanks must have ruptured at the first moment and that gas must have vented harmlessly into the atmosphere. And the problem was considered to be, for the most part, over. There was always a little bit of uncertainty, so that as the digging then proceeded from the surface into the chiller plant, there was real concern. There were procedures that were instituted, and in the end, it turned out that indeed the main chiller plant, Freon, had vented harmlessly.
I'm wondering if you saw many instances here of people competing with each other for financial reasons, you know, to get the contract to haul the stuff or to get the contract to remove. If there were contractors fighting because there was money at stake.
No, it's surprising how little of that happened. The reason is that I think there was great concern by the contractors about liability, and to this day it has not really been resolved. I mean, there was all through that operation, these people were operating without contracts. So, and they also were exposing themselves to a liability. They were operating without insurance. Nobody would insure this operation. So I think there were mixed feelings. People, once they got into it, the contractors, once they got into it, did not want to leave for the reasons that others, whether firemen or policemen, did not want to leave. But there was, I think, no, there was not a lot of maneuvering for profit there.
Why did the Department of Design and Construction in New York get the job to oversee the dismantling of the World Trade Center, as opposed to, say, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Group?
Strange thing that happened. I mean, that's part of the story here. It fits the pattern of this creativity that was going on there and the courage of the American system to allow it to run, to allow the innovation to run. I mean, But everybody was unexpected, including the Department of Design and Construction, totally unexpected. But the two guys who run that department, Kenneth Holden, Mike Burton, his lieutenant, were on the scene. They happened to be at a meeting in City Hall. They were caught by the collapse, so to speak, and responded very effectively from the very first hours, and specifically to bring heavy equipment in to lift the debris to find survivors in the very first hours after the collapse. They were so effective at it that they kept going. And every time the federal government came close to intervening, as it normally would, it backed off. And the attitude was, very courageous. And it was more or less, look, these guys are doing the job. Give them another hour. Give them another hour. Give them another day. And finally, it was formalized. But it was a surprising show of competence allowed to run.
You spent some time underground beneath the World Trade Center. Can you describe a little bit what you saw?
A fantastic place, with chaos all around, often very dark, obviously, sometimes with filtering light, with light coming through the dust and smoke, through the holes and jagged edges. For the most part, very collapsed, very small, moving through crevices and corners, diving sometimes almost headfirst through the ruins, and then that was very hallucinogenic, surreal. And then you would come upon scenes of almost of normalcy underneath there. For instance, the PATH station, almost half of it was remained intact for a long time, and the signs of abandonment there. I mean, the commuter bar, for instance, with its bottles of beer still on the counter, was so you could go on one hand from these very extreme surreal environments in which you could hardly tell what was up and what was down, and all was smoke and darkness, into equally surreal but completely understandable environments, scenes again of sudden abandonment of the old normalcy that no longer, of course, existed.
Right. So do you see this as a saving grace in a way, that when tragedy strikes, when things are at their worst, when fear is all around, that at the same time there is this possibility for a sense of exhilaration, a sense of liberation from the ordinary, and that, I guess if you're lucky, you can live on that for a while?
It's a saving grace. It's a necessary element. If it were not for that, then this country, of course, would very easily collapse from things like this attack, and would certainly be weakened by things like this attack. In fact, what we see, and if you look at the site, what happened at the World Trade Center, honestly, as opposed to engaging in the myth-making, what you see is that this country emerged stronger after the attack, and the strength did not have to do with tragic heroes. The strength had to do with energetic response and problem solving.
William Langevisha, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Langevisha is the author of the new book, American Ground: Unbuilding the World Trade Center. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the new HBO documentary Journeys with George, about how presidential candidate George W. Bush interacted with reporters on the campaign bus. This is Fresh Air. On Election Day, while the broadcast networks and news channels are tallying winners and losers in prime time, HBO is presenting a political documentary. It's a behind-the-scenes look at George W. Bush's presidential campaign in 2000. TV critic David Bianculli says it's impressive and amazing for how behind-the-scenes it actually gets.
You can watch the evening news or BBC World News. You can watch the public affairs shows on Sunday mornings or the screaming talk shows on cable. You can get a sense about how the very serious game of politics is played from Nightline, or from C-SPAN, or from the West Wing. Sooner or later, it all starts to look pretty much the same. But tomorrow night's documentary on HBO, which follows the campaign of George W. Bush from the day he announced his candidacy for president to the day he actually won, looks remarkably different. Alexandra Pelosi, an NBC producer in her late 20s, shot the film as a personal video diary of her 18 months on the road with the Bush press corps. The documentary is called Journeys with George, and one way to demonstrate how much access and playfulness she got on film is that its title was suggested by Bush himself, on camera. It's worth noting that Pelosi is a Democrat from a connected political family. Her mother, a California congresswoman, is Nancy Pelosi, the minority whip. It's also worth noting that Pelosi, though a behind-the-scenes producer, is a character. She always dresses in purple with fingernails painted to match. She has a master's degree in media studies, and she's a bit of an outsider. She's not swept up in Bush's politics, but she's not really a central part of the press corps either. She's an outsider in both camps, which makes her film from the inside that much more revealing. Journeys with George was shot on a small handheld video camcorder. At first, it was just Pelosi's video diary of her days and nights on the press plane, or in the back of small-town auditoriums listening to Bush deliver the same stump speech. But when Bush lost the New Hampshire primary to John McCain, Bush's handlers instantly made him more accessible and put the reporters and the candidate together on the same plane. That's where Bush first interacted with Pelosi's camera. He joked about her filming, but he not only allowed her to continue, but played to the camera. From that point on, Pelosi had a real documentary on her hands. On one occasion, she even had it in his hands. When the candidate's bus breaks down on the way to one campaign stop, he's herded onto the press bus. Bush sits with Pelosi as she films him. Then he takes her camera and begins filming her, and asking her some personal questions.
Okay, let's be serious.
Okay, let's be serious. If you were a tree, what tree would you be?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not, I'm a bush. Let's see, I'm a little quicker than you think, Alexander. Let me have that thing.
There you go.
I saw you walking along a secluded road the other day with a Newsweek man. Now, it's none of my business what your private life is like, but let me ask you this question. Was that just a social encounter with Newsweek man?
That was strictly professional.
Professional? Nothing
as
social
another,
about it.
As a fellow member of the press corps,
yes.
We were discussing your alternative minimum tax and how your tax plan versus the McCain tax plan.
And you
plan.
Felt like you had to hold his hand in order to be able to have that amplify the discussion?
Journeys with George does film Newsweek man and Financial Times man and Dallas Morning News man and lots of other members of the journalistic pack. Sometimes it's funny, with the reporters exhibiting wit and charm. Other times, it's not flattering at all. Bush comes off the very same way. What's most striking about this documentary is how candid it all is. The closest thing to it is Timothy Krause's landmark book about the 1972 presidential campaign, The Boys on the Bus. And that was 30 years ago, and in print. For Pelosi to capture so much of the actual process, an actual candidate, on video, is something I wouldn't have thought possible, especially in a setting where everyone around her is painfully aware of the impact of being filmed. I'm still not sure how she got away with it, but she got such a good film out of it, I'm really glad she did.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schirach. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. And today we're very happy to welcome our new associate producer, Ian Chillog. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track by the Dutch jazz musician and composer Willem Bruecker, who is 58 today. This is Bruecker's arrangement of a movement from Erik Satie's composition Parade, which was first performed in 1917 during World War I by the Diaghilev Ballet, with a libretto by Jean Cocteau and costumes and sets by Pablo Picasso.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum, a medical museum that documents deformed and disfigured bodies and the impact of destructive diseases and trauma. She says while these bodies may be ugly, there is a terrifying beauty in the spirits of those forced to endure these afflictions. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.